Chapter 4. The Executrix. 1. After a hearty breakfast of cold chicken, granola bars, and peanut butter on crackers, Nick stuffed his backpack and set off on his bike for the 2-mile ride to his grandparents' home. When he arrived, he called Bruce and reported that their part of the island had electricity. Some of the neighbors had returned, and work groups were getting organized to clean up the debris and tack FEMA tarps across damaged roofs. The busy streets were passable, and traffic was moving about, but many of the side streets were still blocked. According to a policeman, the southern half of the island had full power, and downtown could expect it later in the day. For the northern half, it could be another week. Bob was antsy and tired of camping out. He wanted to go home, but with no car and no electricity, he would be hot and stranded. He hung around and helped Bruce pick up litter in the backyard. They helped a neighbor cut up branches and remove hanging gutters. It was August 10th, and a high of 98 was predicted. At 9:20, Bruce got a text from Polly McCann. She had landed in Jacksonville and was searching for a rental car. "It'll take hours," he said to Bob. "Poor girl." Bored with hard labor, they headed toward Nelson's place to see if the state police had arrived. For almost an hour, they drove the island to observe the destruction and the cleanup. They stopped at Mercer's cottage and walked around it. Bruce shot a video and sent it to her. Amy lived in a high-end gated community a mile inland. The gate was missing, and they drove the streets. Fallen trees were everywhere, but Amy's home had been spared serious damage. He shot another video and sent it to her. The hospital had reopened, and its parking lot was full. Two large vans were parked at Nelson's, one in the drive and the other in the street. To make sure everyone knew serious matters were at hand, both vans were marked in bold letters, "Florida State Police, Crime Scene Unit." Two unmarked cars were parked in the street. A few neighbors gawked from their porches. Bruce and Bob stood at the police tape and finally caught a glimpse of Captain Wesley Butler. He walked over with a friendly hello, shook their hands, and lit a cigarette. After a round of meaningless chit-chat, Bruce asked, "So how's it going in there?"
"Can't discuss it,"
Butler said officially. "Of course not," Bob mumbled sarcastically. Bruce wanted to ask, "What about the damn hard drive?" But he knew he would get nothing. Butler asked,
"Where's your third amigo, that kid who knew everything?"
"We fired him," Bruce said. "He's off the case. Say, look, Mr. Kerr's sister will be here later today, flying in from California. She'll want to see his place, maybe gather some personal items. What are the rules here?" Butler was already shaking his head.
"Sorry, no one goes in until we're finished, and we'll be here all day. Good way to kill a Saturday, huh?"
Well, he's been dead for 5 days, Bruce thought. About time you got here. But that was unfair. The storm had upset all schedules and routines. Butler excused himself and returned to his work. Two technicians in white mummy suits hauled out a rolled-up rug and placed it in a van. What about the damned hard drive? Bruce realized that neither he nor the family would know anything about the investigation for days or perhaps weeks. Standing at the police tape, he was as close as he would get to the evidence. As they were leaving, a neighbor walked over and asked, "What's going on here?" "It's a crime scene," Bruce said, nodding at the two vans with billboards painted on all sides. "Nelson was killed during the storm."
"Nelson's dead?" the neighbor gasped.
"Afraid so. Head wounds."
"Why are the police here?"
"You'll have to ask them." They drove to Bob's condo and spent an hour hauling trash and debris to the curb. It was depressing work, made even worse by the heat. An insurance adjuster had promised to stop by later in the day. There was a rumor that Curly's Oyster Bar was open down south near the Grand Surf Hotel, and they decided to explore. 2. Polly McCann arrived at Bruce's shortly after 2 and knocked on the door.
The doorbell wasn't working because the electricity had not yet reached downtown. She was about 50, California slim and trendy, with a smart boy's haircut and designer eyewear. After a long night on the plane, she looked remarkably fresh. Bruce offered her a bottle of cold water, and they sat in the den and began covering the preliminaries. She taught physics at a community college in Redwood City. Her husband chaired the math department. They had two sons, both in college at UC Santa Barbara. Her parents were in their early 80s and battling more health issues than most of their friends. They were devastated by Nelson's death and unable to make decisions. Polly was his only sibling and had been handling their parents' affairs for years. Nelson's ex-wife had already remarried and divorced again and would not be a factor. Their parting 10 years earlier had left scars, and they truly loathed each other. Mercifully, there were no children.
"He didn't talk about the divorce, and I knew better than to ask," Bruce said.
"The marriage was a bad idea from day one," she said. "Nelson finished Stanford Law at the top of his class and took a big job with a high-powered firm in San Francisco. It was a grind, 90 hours a week, lots of pressure. For some reason, he decided to further complicate his life by marrying Sally, a real flake who drank too much, worked too little, and was looking for money. I tried to talk him out of it because I couldn't stand the woman, but he wouldn't listen to me. They quarreled constantly, so he put in even more hours at the office. He made partner at 31 and was knocking down close to $1 million a year. Then he realized that one of his clients was illegally selling military software to some authoritarian governments, and he wanted to blow the whistle. He did talk to me about that. He knew his legal career would be over. You can't rat out a client and expect to survive as a lawyer. But he thought the government would make it worth the trouble. Plus, he was really sick of the big firm racket. So he did the right thing, got a check for $5 million in return, and happily fled the office. But his timing was bad. He should have pursued the divorce before he blew the whistle. His wife lawyered up, and they found evidence of an affair with a co-worker. He lost big, cracked up, and we had to put him away for 6 months. Then he started writing. Does this sound like whatever he's told you?"
"Pretty close. He never told me how much he received from the government. He did say that she had better lawyers and clearly won the divorce. I got the impression it was a brutal ordeal."
"How well did you know him?"
"Have you had lunch?"
Bruce was happy to share his peanut butter and crackers, but was suddenly nervous about offering food to a fairly hip Californian. No doubt she survived on nothing but raw vegetables and protein shakes. She smiled and hesitated and said, "Actually, I'm starving."
"Then step into my kitchen, where the air is slightly cooler than out on the street."
She followed him to the snack bar and watched as he rummaged through the pantry and found a can of tomato soup. "Perfect," she said.
"And for appetizers, we can offer chunky peanut butter and saltines."
"My favorite," she said, much to his surprise.
He put the soup on and opened the peanut butter. "How well did I know Nelson Kerr?" "Well, I considered him a friend. We're about the same age with similar interests. He's been here for several dinner parties. I've been to his place. We've had dinners out. My wife fixed him up with one of her friends, but the romance lasted less than a month. He was not that aggressive with women. We spent time at the bookstore drinking coffee and talking about books and writers. I thought his pace was a bit slow for a genre author and encouraged him to write more. But I do that with most of my writers."
"Your writers?"
"Yes. There's a clan of them on the island, and I'm the den mother. I encourage all of them to write more, so I'll have more to sell."
"How well did Nelson sell?"
"His last book did about 100,000 copies in print and digital combined, and his numbers were steadily increasing. I pushed him to do a book a year. He was on the right trajectory with his career, but Nelson had a lazy streak. I said that to him once, and he gave some lame excuse about still being tired from Big Law. I said that was nonsense.
Did you ever read his stuff before he sent it to New York?
No. With some writers, I do. But I'm known to have a lot of opinions, so most shy away from my editing. Nelson asked me to read his latest, said he had finished the first draft and was polishing up the second. Bruce decided he would discuss the hard drive later. There was so much ground to cover. He poured the soup in a bowl and presented it to her. She smiled and said, "Thanks." "What color wine do you think goes best with tomato soup?" he asked.
"Let's postpone the wine."
She stirred the soup, blew on a spoonful, and tasted it.
"Compliments to the chef."
"Don't mention it."
"So, Bruce, was my brother murdered?"
He took a deep breath, walked to the fridge, opened it to fetch a beer, realized he'd had two already, removed nothing, closed the door, and leaned against it with his arms folded across his chest. "I'm not sure, but a few things are certain. Number one, Nelson is dead." He described Nelson's body when they found him. He summarized Dr. Landrum's summary of the autopsy and cause of death. She listened without blinking, without emotion, and without eating her soup. And number two, there was a woman involved, Ingrid. He took a deep breath and told Bob's story from start to finish, slowly, and with every detail he knew. Polly stared at the table and never picked up her spoon. And number three, the police are investigating now, at this moment, and you can't enter Nelson's condo until they're through.
"Sounds like murder to me,"
she said softly, but again with no emotion. "It's murder, Polly. Any suspects come to mind? Something from his past that he never shared with anyone here on the island?"
"Well, Ingrid is certainly a suspect."
"Indeed.
But why? They had just met. If she had no motive, then she did it for money."
She shook her head and shoved the bowl away. The soup was cold, and it was probably the last can of Campbell's tomato. Bruce hated to see it wasted, but the stores were reopening, and it was time for a grocery run. It takes a disaster to make you appreciate the basics.
"I don't know," she said. "I can't think of anyone. As far as I know, his only enemy is his ex-wife, but she got the money and lost interest. You have a theory?"
"Yes. And mind you, I've spent the last 5 days with Andrew Cobb, Bob as we call him for some reason, who's a convicted felon, who now writes some pretty graphic crime novels. He's out there in a hammock snoring off his lunch of oysters and beer. You'll meet him soon enough. And there's a visiting student here named Nick Sutton who works in the store and reads virtually every crime novel published. We've had more than enough time to kick around various theories."
"And your best one is?"
"It's a long shot, but we have to start somewhere. Ingrid was a pro who came and went and will likely never be found. The man who paid her is someone who doesn't want Nelson's next book to be published."
"That's pretty far-fetched."
"Agreed. But right now, we have nothing else." She squinted her eyes and mulled it over. After a moment, she asked,
"And do you know what the book is about?"
"Not a clue. Do you?" She shook her head.
"I found his books difficult to read, and we never talked about them. In fact, we haven't talked much at all since he moved here. Nelson was a loner, especially after his troubles."
"He was paranoid about getting hacked. It's happened to some writers and musicians. Stuff was stolen, so he wrote offline. Somehow the bad guys knew what he was writing."
"Oh, Nelson was definitely paranoid. He rarely used email. He even thought his phones were tapped. We corresponded by old-fashioned snail mail."
"How quaint. I got the impression that he was always looking over his shoulder."
"No doubt," she said. "And he wasn't like that until the whistleblowing episode."
"And you say he cracked up?"
after the divorce, which, as I said, happened after his departure from the law firm. Severe depression, or a nervous breakdown, or whatever they called it. We locked him away in a fancy joint for 6 months, and he made a nice recovery. Still in therapy, though.
For the first time, her eyes were moist. She removed her glasses and blinked a few times.
About a month ago, I received an overnight package from Nelson. In a letter, he said he was enclosing his latest novel on a thumb drive, wanted me to hold it for safekeeping. He asked me not to read it until further notice. He gave me his new phone number. I wrote him back and asked why he was changing his phone number again. But he never answered, never explained.
Where's the thumb drive?
In my pocket.
Let's keep it there. And you haven't read the novel?
Not a word. And you don't want to?
Bruce looked at her untouched tomato soup and asked, Are you finished? She had had two sips and two crackers.
Yes. I'm sorry, my appetite vanished.
Let's go back to the den. Where's cooler? They moved to the den, and he closed the door to the kitchen. Out on the veranda, Bob's bare feet were visible, dangling from the hammock. Bruce said, I'd rather not read the novel. Not now, anyway. Because I want to answer no if I'm ever asked by the police.
Will the police find it?
I don't know. I'm sure they'll confiscate his computers and get search warrants to look at everything. But if I were a gambler, I'd bet the desktop hard drive was snatched about the same time Nelson was murdered.
Should I hand over the thumb drive?
For now, let's say no. You can always do it later, or not.
I'm confused. Under your theory, Nelson was likely murdered because of this novel I'm holding in my pocket, right?
It's just a theory. And a shaky one at best.
But it's all you have, right?
Right. He was killed by a professional for a reason.
Got that. So someone has to read the novel to begin unraveling the crime. Who? You? Me? The police?
Bob's feet slowly dropped to the tiled floor of the veranda. The rest of him followed, and he stood for a long minute stretching and rubbing his eyes like a bear leaving hibernation. As things slowly came into focus, he got his bearings and lumbered toward the door. Bruce said, Bob's done with his nap. He's a member of the team, so we'll need to brief him.
And the thumb drive?
Sure. He'll have an opinion or two. Plus, he's a convicted felon with a brilliant criminal mind who doesn't trust cops and prosecutors. Bob stepped into the den and introduced himself to Polly. 3. The lights flickered, came on, went off, came on again, and Bruce and Bob held their breath. When it was apparent that the electricity was back for good, they exchanged high fives and couldn't stop grinning. Bruce quickly adjusted thermostats and left to turn off the generator, whose constant rattling had gotten under his skin. Civilization was back, with hot showers, cold water, clean clothes, television, the works. The camping trip was over. However, they managed to temper their excitement in the presence of a grieving sister. Bob agreed that they should sit on the thumb drive until they heard from Wesley Butler, if indeed he bothered to call. He had promised to do so when his crime scene unit finished its business.
Polly asked, Do the investigators meet with the victim's family for updates? I'm sorry, but I have no idea what to expect.
Bruce said, I don't have a clue. Luckily, I've not been through this before. Bob said, I had a buddy in prison one time. His family went through a murder. It was awful and all that. But to make matters worse, the cops wouldn't tell them anything. They finally hired a lawyer to get some information.
I'd prefer not to hire a lawyer, she said. I just hired a mortician.
You won't have to do that, Bruce said as sympathetically as possible. Our police chief is a good guy, and I can talk to him.
Thank you.
Would you like to rest? Your bedroom is upstairs and is now much cooler.
That would be lovely, Bruce. Thank you.
She went to her rental car and fetched an overnight bag. Bruce showed her to a guest room and closed the door. He returned to the den and sat across from Bob, who said, I like her. She's far too old for you, Bob. She's almost your age.
Well, Ingrid was 40 or so, so I can be flexible.
You'll never outgrow the young divorcees in string bikinis.
I hope not. Why did I bring up her name? You know, Bruce, looking back, there was something odd about her. The whole time I was with her, and through everything we did, it was like her mind was somewhere else, always calculating, always planning her next move. She was detached from the moment, as if she was just going through the motions. I mean, I really didn't care because the sex was pretty great. Now I guess it makes sense. But how was I to know?
You can't beat yourself up over her, Bob. No one could have predicted it. You were having fun with a nice-looking woman.
No doubt about that, but it does nag at me.
You gotta let it go.
I'll try. I need a shower. My last one was in Lake City, I believe, in a square tub with an empty tube of shampoo. Seems like a month ago.
Upstairs on the right. She's on the left, so give her plenty of space. I guess you're piling in for a few more days. Welcome again.
Thanks, but I'm leaving soon for Maine. I want cooler weather, and I need to get away from this place. The insurance company is already giving me the runaround, and I don't feel like fighting right now. How long is she staying?
She just got here. I have no idea. She mentioned a memorial service next Saturday in California, and I'm already thinking of ways to avoid it.
That would be just awful. I quit doing funerals years ago. Such a waste of time and money and emotion.
When he was gone, Bruce tidied up the kitchen and left for his next adventure, a trip to the nearest grocery store. 4. At dusk, Bruce and Polly left his house in the Tahoe and headed north. A few blocks from downtown, the island became dark again as they drove into areas still without electricity. Polly was stunned by the devastation. She had never witnessed firsthand the aftermath of a major storm. Neither had Bruce, for that matter. But after 5 days, he was growing accustomed to downed utility poles, blocked streets, overturned vehicles, front lawns filled with soaked rugs and furniture, and mountains of debris and garbage. They passed a small church where dozens of FEMA trailers were assembled in neat rows in a parking lot, and people were waiting quietly in a long line to be served dinner brought in by volunteers. They passed a park where a tent city had sprung up. Parents sat in lawn chairs around a fire pit while children kicked soccer balls in disorganized games. Next to the park, on a softball field, National Guardsmen were handing out bottles of water and loaves of bread. Bruce found the street in an old section of post-war tract homes, all of which were damaged and uninhabitable. In most driveways, shiny new FEMA trailers now sat next to cars and trucks. Some had pipes running to the sewage lines, others did not. From the looks of the houses, the trailers would be used for a long time. Wanda Clary had been Bruce's first employee when Bay Books opened 23 years earlier. As the only holdover from the prior owner, Wanda assumed from day one that she knew far more about selling books than her new boss, and though she was right, she wrongly tried to assert too much control. They clashed early and often, and Bruce thought about firing her on many occasions, but she was loyal, punctual, and willing to work for the low wages he offered in the early days. As he learned almost immediately, in retail, dependable help is hard to find. With time, they staked out their own duties and turfs, and Wanda held on to her job, if only by a thread. Before her stroke, she was often abrupt with Bruce, short with customers, and rude to co-workers. But after her stroke, which, as it turned out, was not that serious, not the first one anyway, her entire personality changed dramatically, and Wanda became everybody's grandmother. Customers adored her, and sales increased. Bruce paid her more, and they became friends. But the second stroke almost killed her and forced her retirement. Her husband died shortly thereafter, and Wanda, who was pushing 80, had been barely surviving on a pension for the past 10 years. She was sitting in a lawn chair beside her FEMA trailer, chatting with a neighbor, when Bruce surprised her. She managed to stand with a cane and gave him a big hug. He introduced Polly as a friend from California. Wanda introduced her neighbor, a lady not much younger than her, and offered them seats in her kitchen chairs, which had been arranged in the driveway near the trailer. Much of the rest of the furniture was piled near the street to be hauled away one day. Wanda said her house had taken 8 feet of water that had not subsided for 3 days. Everything was ruined, same as her neighbors. Most of them had no flood insurance, nor did Wanda, and the future was pretty grim. The FEMA trailer was free for 90 days with a possible extension, which made no sense. What was FEMA planning to do with the trailers when they took them away? Wait for the next Cat 4? Wanda and her neighbor had survived the storm in a shelter on higher ground, and they managed to find a little humor in their story. It was a frightening experience, one that they would never forget. Both vowed to evacuate the next time. Bruce told a few stories about the storm, but said nothing about Nelson Kerr. He doubted if Wanda had met him, though she still read almost everything. Polly just listened and tried to absorb the surroundings. 24 hours earlier, she was leaving the safety of San Francisco. Now she was sitting in a war zone with people who were sleepwalking through a nightmare, people who had lost everything and were happy to have a warm bed in a dark, tiny trailer. For a moment, she almost forgot about her brother. Across the street, a small gas engine came to life, then a light bulb. Wanda said,
"That's Gilbert. His son brought him a generator yesterday, and he's showing it off. Says he might be able to rig up a small window unit for some cool air."
"Have you talked to your son?" Bruce asked.
"Well, yes, finally. We didn't get phone service until Thursday. Phil called yesterday from St. Louis, asked if I needed anything. Nothing really, I said. Just a new house, new car, new furniture. Some food might be nice. A bottle of cold water. He said he'd do what he could, which of course means nothing."
Changing the subject and ready to leave, Bruce said, "We brought some water and food." He left and walked to the Tahoe. Polly followed him, and they hauled 4 cases of bottled water and 3 boxes of groceries to the trailer. Bruce took a quick look inside and was overwhelmed by the thought of living in such tight quarters for any length of time. Wanda was crying, and Bruce held her hand for a few minutes. He promised to come back and made her promise to call if she needed anything. When they left, a crowd was gathering around Gilbert's light bulb, and there was music on the radio. 5. On the southern end of Camino Island, Curly's Oyster Bar was crowded with locals looking for comfort food and a cold drink, and utility crews killing time on a Saturday night. Bruce and Polly waited half an hour and got a table outside on the deck. Of course, she did not eat fried foods and had never confronted a raw oyster. They settled on a bucket of boiled shrimp and waited on beers. She preferred white wine, but Bruce steered her away from the boxed stuff poured at Curly's. The music from the jukebox was soft and distant, and the conversations around them were subdued, as if folks had just stumbled out of the nightmare and were still stunned by the changes. There was too much work to be done to feel good about life. In a low voice, Bruce said, "So you're the executor of Nelson's estate?"
"I am. He made a new will last year and named me as executor, or executrix, to be more precise. The gender thing.
Who drafted the will?
A law firm in Jacksonville.
Have you talked to them yet?
No. Why the interest in his estate?
Just curious, that's all. I assume he had some assets. She sighed, removed her designer frames, and rubbed her eyes.
How much do you know about Nelson's business?
Not much at all. Mostly the stuff we've covered, legal career, bad divorce, blowing the whistle. He let it slip once that he paid $1 million for his condo, but other than that, I have no idea what's in the bank.
And his publishing contracts?
Nothing. I never asked, he never offered. As we know, he didn't talk much. She put her glasses back on as two tall draft beers appeared on the table. She began,
"He left the law at the age of 32, 11 years ago. At the time, he was making it big, but spending a lot, too. What he didn't spend, his wife did. They saved virtually nothing because the future had no limits. As I said, the government paid him $5 million in exchange for the scoop on his crooked clients, but he thought it would be a lot more. Half of it went for taxes. We pay a lot in California."
Another reason to live in Florida. Zero income taxes.
A bit too red for me. Anyway, he and Sally were at war, and not long after the money arrived, she filed for divorce. After fees and such, he walked away with about $1 million. A lot of that went for therapy. Then he started writing and made some money, I guess. Again, Nelson rarely talked about his business.
Who inherits?
A third to me, two-thirds to our parents. A pretty simple will. I'm also the administrator of his literary estate, whatever that means.
It means you'll handle all the rights to his novels. Hardback, paper, digital, U.S., foreign, maybe even TV and film. Plus you'll sell the latest novel, if it doesn't get you killed.
Thanks.
One good thing about dying young is that it usually means a spike in royalties.
Are you trying to be funny?
Yes.
Well, don't.
Sorry. The waitress placed the bucket of boiled shrimp between them and disappeared. They peeled and ate for a few minutes, then slowed down for a little beer. She asked,
"So what's up tomorrow?"
"Our friend from the state police called. He wants us to gather at the station and spend a few hours going over what we know and what they've found. Should be interesting."
"And the thumb drive?"
"They may ask us what we know about his last novel, especially if the hard drive is missing. I want to truthfully say that I've never seen it."
"I feel like I need a lawyer."
"You gotta hire one sooner or later to probate the estate here in Florida."
"Do you know a good one?"
"One or two, but it might be hard to find them right now."
"Okay, if you're playing dumb, then I'm playing dumb for now."
"We'll be fine. These cops are not the sharpest ones you'll ever meet."
"Am I supposed to be comforted by that?"
"No." 6. The Santa Rosa Police Department was housed in the rear of City Hall, a sprawling mix of add-ons and afterthoughts situated two blocks from the harbor and thus deluged by Leo. The complex had been soaked, was still wet, and all its systems would remain inoperable for a long time to come. Temporary police quarters were in the process of being established in a middle school gymnasium a mile inland. When Bruce, Polly, Bob, and Nick arrived punctually at 10 on Sunday morning, the school's parking lot was crowded with patrol cars, city vehicles, and contractors' trucks. Inside the gym, crews were working to erect temporary walls and doors. No one knew where anyone else was, so Bruce used his cell phone to find Wesley Butler, somewhere in the rear, near the boys' locker room. They followed him down a hallway to an empty classroom where Carl Logan, the chief of police, and Hoppy Durden, ace homicide detective, were waiting with two technicians from the crime lab. Quick introductions were made, with Butler taking charge. First, they wanted to videotape the statements from Bruce, Bob, and Nick, so a camera and lights were set up in one corner. Bruce and Nick went first. While they answered the same questions, Bob walked across the hall with the two technicians. Using a 14-inch laptop, they began working on a composite photo of Ingrid. Butler interviewed Polly and quizzed her about the family and as much of Nelson's background as possible. He did not ask her about the current novel. When she asked if they found the hard drive, he wouldn't answer. Half an hour later, the technicians printed a color rendering of Ingrid, and Bob was amazed at the likeness. He warned them, though, that the blonde hair was fake. The woman, whoever she was, looked to be around 40, as Bob had been saying, with high cheekbones, twinkling hazel eyes, long blonde hair on the darker side, a comely smile that would invite men of all ages to sit right down and buy her a drink. Gawking at the composite, Bruce found it hard to believe that this lovely creature was capable of such a vicious murder. Poison, maybe, but not a beating with a blunt weapon. Polly was asked if she wanted to view any of the photographs of her brother on his patio. She said no. She was not ready for that. Butler briefly reviewed the autopsy findings with Bruce and Polly and downplayed the gruesome parts. Not surprisingly, they had so far found no witnesses, no neighbors who saw anyone coming or going during the storm. All the neighbors were gone, Bruce thought, but said nothing. He listened as he and Nick were fingerprinted. Because Bob was a felon, his were already on file. When the videotaping was finished, they gathered around a folding table littered with files and reports. Butler summarized what was already known and what they expected to soon learn. They found blood on two walls, on the bathroom vanity, and in the rugs. All samples were at the lab to be matched against Nelson's. They had also lifted many fingerprints, but analyzing those would take time. They were trying to get information from the Hilton, registration records, surveillance footage, and so on. But for obvious reasons, that was being delayed. As life returned to normal, they would gather info from other nearby hotels and condo rentals in an effort to identify Ingrid. But Butler spoke as though he knew that effort would be fruitless. Before the meeting, Bruce had decided that the best tactic going in was to say as little as possible. The police didn't know much anyway, and asking a dozen questions would A, yield few answers, and B, only alienate Butler and Logan. They were tired and irritated to be working on a Sunday morning, and it became obvious that the review session was only a formality. Butler made his biggest mistake when he said,
"We've examined the golf clubs and fireplace hardware and everything else in the condo that could have been used as a murder weapon. And so far, nothing. Assuming, of course, it was a murder."
Polly quickly asked, "You think it was something other than murder?"
"Perhaps. There was a lot of stuff in the air, Ms. McCann."
Logan jumped in with, "Having now survived a Category 4, Ms. McCann, I can assure you that the amount of debris and junk falling and blowing around in all directions is hard to imagine. You have to see it to believe it. We think it's possible that your brother got hit more than once with limbs, pieces of the roof, or maybe bricks. Who knows?"
Bruce took a deep breath, as did Bob and Nick. Polly gritted her teeth and said nothing. Butler knew they were not happy with this and said,
"But we're not sure, and we'll investigate everything. It'll take some time, as always."
Bruce cleared his throat and asked, "What about the hard drive from his computer?" Butler glanced at Logan, who looked at Hoppy, who appeared to be on the verge of a quick nap. Butler said,
"We have the hard drive, but it's encrypted. Our guys in the lab will play with it again tomorrow, but it looks pretty secure."
Bruce had heard enough. He stood and said, "Anything else?" Everyone suddenly stood and began the forced ritual of shaking hands, saying thanks, and promising to keep in touch. As Bruce walked out of the room, he wondered if he would ever see Wesley Butler again. Driving away, he glanced to his right and saw Polly wiping away a tear, but she said nothing, not for a long time.
In the rear seat, Nick and Bob were just as quiet, both angry at the police, but also mentally packing their bags. Bob was now cleared to leave the island and would do so within hours. Nick was needed at college, where he would party for a week to celebrate the end of summer, and then head to Venice for a rough semester abroad. 7. Monday morning, Bruce followed Polly to the Jacksonville airport, where she returned her rental. They drove to the funeral home, where she finished some paperwork and wrote a check. Nelson's body would be transferred to the airport for the flight home, with his sister riding above him in coach. Back at the airport, Bruce walked her inside, and they found a coffee shop in the main terminal. Nelson's condo was still guarded by police tape, and Butler wasn't sure when it would be released. Bruce knew the best mover on the island and agreed to oversee the removal of Nelson's furniture and possessions. He would get it cataloged and stored, and in a few weeks, Polly would return to deal with it. Bruce knew several of the good realtors on the island and would arrange for them to look at the condo and discuss a listing, but cautioned her that the market would be soft for some time. He had a friend who dealt in German imports and could probably sell the car at a fair price. They sipped coffee and watched the foot traffic. She said, "Nelson's memorial service is this Saturday. I don't suppose you could be there." Bruce had been contemplating several ways to avoid a trip to the West Coast for what would be a dreadful event. But in the split second he had to come up with a believable response, he completely choked. Whether he wanted it or not, he was the Kerr's family point man on the scene, and they needed him. "Of course," he managed to say, with just enough conviction. "I'll send along the details as they come together. It will mean a lot to my parents. They're so desperate for information." Can't wait, thought Bruce. How could his presence possibly mean anything to her parents, people he had never met, and after the service would never see again? "Sure, I'll be there. San Francisco?"
"Dublin, east of the city."
"Will there be a crowd?"
"Who knows? He had friends in the area, and the old gang from Stanford, but they've scattered. Could you possibly say a few words?"
The dreadful event just got a lot worse. Bruce, though, was suddenly quicker. "I can't do it, Polly. I've tried before and just can't maintain my composure. Sorry."
"No problem. I understand."
"The cops didn't ask about Nelson's manuscript," he said.
"I know. What are you thinking?"
"I'm thinking the book needs to be read, but not by you, not by me. Not by anyone even remotely connected to Nelson."
"I'm listening."
"I want you to send it to a writer named Mercer Mann. She's from the island but didn't know your brother. These days, she's teaching at Ole Miss. She can be trusted. She'll read it, share it with her boyfriend, a former journalist and writer himself. Then I'll talk to them." She shrugged as if she would do whatever he asked.
"And you think the manuscript will lead the cops to the killer?"
"I wouldn't put too much confidence in the police. It's a tough case to solve, and they already have a more convenient theory. Blame it on the victim for wandering around outside in the storm. They'll shuffle papers and ignore our calls and wait for some time to pass. And then one day they'll break the news to you that the investigation has gone nowhere, which is exactly where it's headed right now. They'll promise to keep the file open and hope for a miracle." She nodded and said,
"I'm afraid I agree with you."
"I seriously doubt the manuscript will lead to the killer, but it's the only possible clue we have right now. That, and a pretty good description of Dear Ingrid."
"He was killed for a reason, Bruce. Nelson had no enemies. He was a lovely man who enjoyed life and wouldn't harm a flea."
Her voice wavered for a second, and her eyes watered. Bruce handed her a folded piece of paper. "Here's Mercer's address in Oxford. She's waiting and will read it immediately." Polly wiped her eyes and nodded.
Thank you, Bruce, for everything.
They walked to the security checkpoint and hugged goodbye. 8. On Tuesday, 8 days after the storm, Bruce waited all morning at Bay Books for a contractor who didn't show. The insurance adjuster promised to swing by for another look, but he, too, was busy elsewhere. Most of the downtown shops were still closed. Some were digging out and tossing spoiled merchandise into dumpsters. Others were locked and dark. The streets were empty. Many of the island's residents had returned, but they were in no mood to shop. All tourists were gone and wouldn't be back for months, maybe years. On Wednesday, another contractor failed to show. Bruce walked home, changed into jeans, and went to welcome Myra and Lee. They were working at a reasonable pace, hauling debris and trash to the curb, until he arrived, at which time they found chairs in the shade and poured drinks and supervised his labors. Bruce was expected to move the heavier stuff, moldy rugs, piles of wet books, etc. He strained and sweated as they drank and talked about the horrors of surviving Leo. When he was soaked, he finally asked for a break and a drink. Inside, in the cool air, they gathered in the den. The television was on mute. Myra walked in front of it, stopped as if frozen with fear, and said, "You gotta be kidding." She moved away, and on the screen, a weatherman was pointing to a mass in the Atlantic. Hurricane Oscar was still days away, but one projected path, one of many, had it heading their way.
"I can't take it," Lee said.
By Thursday morning, Oscar was a bit closer and even more menacing. Its cone of possible targets had narrowed slightly, but another direct hit on the island was a possibility. That afternoon, Bruce drove to Jacksonville, boarded a flight to Atlanta, and from there, flew to San Francisco. 9. He was sitting in the elegant Regency bar of the Fairmont Hotel downtown when she walked in. Noelle had been gone for a month, off to Europe to see friends in Switzerland and family in France, and to get away from the Florida summer heat. She had watched with horror as the hurricane pummeled the island, and she had reluctantly followed his advice to stay away. There was little to do at the moment. She looked like a model, and Bruce embraced and kissed her. That she had spent the last month with Jean-Luc was of no consequence. They had known each other for years, since long before Bruce came along, and their relationship was not going to change. She needed both men, and they adored her. They ordered a drink and talked about Nelson Kerr, a friend she had liked immensely. Bruce brought her up to date with his death, the possibility of murder, Polly's visit, and so on. In Bruce's opinion, as well as Bob's and Nick's, there was no doubt that it was murder. Noelle was shocked by this. Bruce told her about Nelson's novel and the thumb drive. There were no secrets between the two. A wide-open marriage makes secrets unnecessary. The couple trusted each other implicitly and shared everything. Noelle liked the idea of Mercer reading the manuscript first. No one would suspect her.
"Did you and Mercer spend any time together?"
"No, she has a new boyfriend, Thomas, and he was in the way. You'll like him. Cute boy."
"Can't wait. So you have a trip planned. Let's hear it."
"Well, we'll do the service tomorrow, then leave Sunday morning for a little road trip through Napa. Lunch with Rodney on the mountain. There's a new winemaker. Remember that Lance cab that blew us away?"
"Of course."
"We're pen pals now, and I promised him a visit. Then we'll make our way to Oregon and the Willamette Valley to taste some new Pinots. Sound okay?"
"Sounds marvelous. Sounds like you're happy to be off the island."
"Yes, and I'm happy you're here. The island's a mess, and it won't improve much while we're away. It's quite depressing, Noelle. It'll take years."
"We'll survive. Poor Nelson.
I know. We'll give him a proper send-off tomorrow.